This is Caught in the Act with Tim Clark.
Welcome back. Kimberly Heptonstall was the life of the party, everyone's friend. She was 32 years old, she was bright, she loved getting her nails done, wearing colours. She loved helping others, she worked with the deaf. She loved animals, particularly her puppy Isabella, and she adored being an auntie and a sister and a daughter to her mum Linda, who she described as her best friend and biggest support. And Kim also had a partner, Travis Barnard. They had met online and got engaged in June 2017. And despite some turbulence in their relationship, as of July 2019, they were together, living together, sharing each other's lives. Until, after a planned elective surgery, Kim lost her life, suddenly and tragically. The loss devastated her family and left her partner bereaved and apparently grieving. What Travis Barnard did on the day his partner died in 2019 led him into court this week. Actions that to anyone who has lost someone too young are hard to hear and hard to believe. Joining me to discuss the issues around the case of the State of Western Australia versus Travis Paul Barnard is Damien Cripps, one of the hardest working criminal lawyers in Perth and who some might remember was also a regular contributor to the West Australian's Claremont in Conversation podcasts. Damien, so great to be back in conversation with you, mate.
Mr. Clark, thank you so much for having me back in. I feel refreshed and revived after a break after the Claremont material.
I think we all needed a break after that marathon.
But as you understand, and this podcast shows to everyone, these kind of things don't stop. They just keep going, don't they?
Exactly. And so before we get into the details of this case, give the Caught in the Act listeners a glimpse into your life and work at Hay Street Legal.
Hay Street Legal is what I would say a little boutique firm that deals mainly in criminal matters. We do a lot of restraining orders. We do traffic and sometimes delve into other areas as well. And my life comprises, most likely, like a lot of the listeners, I get up, I go to work, I deal with all the people, clients, judges, magistrates, reporters, and go home and try to have some peace and tranquility and spend some quality time with my kids.
Yeah. And lots of appearances in lots of courts all over Perth and in the region. So I see you with your briefcase rushing hither and thither most days. It's pretty relentless, the work of a criminal lawyer when the phone can ring at any point in the day or night.
I just recently had a matter where I was appearing in the Armidale Magistrates Court, Tim, and I've never done this before. I also had a coinciding appearance in the South Hedland Magistrates Court, and I had to ask the magistrate in the Armidale Court to stand my matter down so I could appear in South Hedland. It seems comical, but the logistics of it are that a lot of these matters can be dealt with quite quickly, but it does have you running around all over the place.
Yeah, two places at once. Well, it was a building just down the road from Damien's office in the heart of Perth's legal quarter that Travis Barnard has recently been having to report to every day by 9:15 a.m. The district court building where he was being tried on a single charge, using a telecommunications device to commit a serious offence, in this case, fraud. The date of that alleged offence was July 20th, 2019, the same day that paramedics declared Kimberly Heptonstall dead, having tried to revive her from the moment they arrived at her Woodbridge home. She'd only been home herself a couple of days, having been in hospital for gastric sleeve surgery. She had been discharged to recover. But on a Saturday morning, it was Barnard who had found her unresponsive in the bedroom. It was he who had called the ambulance, and he could only watch as the emergency responders tried desperately to pump any sign of life back into Kimberly Heptonstall. But tragically, she was gone. And by 9:30 a.m., so were those first responders, leaving Barnard the terrible task of telling her family that she had died aged just 32. Damien, you haven't been involved directly in this case, but obviously you would have been immersed in many others where you're dealing with normal people, dealing with sometimes extraordinary trauma and tragedy. So professionally, what's that experience like? You know, and how do you approach it?
Well, I think, Tim, the best way to explain it would be to say that every experience is different. A lot of the same responses can arise, but for the most part, when people come into my office, and likely a lot of my colleagues, they are experiencing some kind of trauma, whether it's just the fact that they're dealing with the justice system or a death, or that they've been involved in the death of somebody. Mm. And my approach is just, the starting point is just to listen, because it'll give you a measure of how the person's coping with it, what merit you can put in what they're saying, as in how much you can take on board and use, or how much of it is a response to the trauma that they're experiencing. So it's, and look, I think for most people that when they're dealing with a trauma, they say things that they might not normally say. They react in a way that they might not normally react. So in my role is to listen and just from my experience, try to work out what I can take on board and what I need to put to one side.
And often, not all cases, but plenty of cases also involve some sort of family conflict, whether it be sort of emotional or personal or financial, or, you know, sometimes a combination of all three. So how do you tiptoe through all those factors while you're also having to listen and perform your role for the court, which is take instructions and, you know, present a case that is not only sort of, you know, in your case, most cases a defence, but it's also got to be, you know, truthful and done the proper way, while also dealing with, you know, competing versions of events, shall we say, sometimes.
I think, Tim, interestingly, what you say there is our obligation to the rules. And as lawyers, there's a myriad of rules that we have to be across and operate on a daily basis. And a lot of the listeners or people who have met with a lawyer or experienced interaction with a lawyer will sometimes come away from that feeling not offended, but sometimes a little perplexed about the way that that interaction took place. And a lot of that is to do with that word that you say, conflict. And on a personal level, all the while you can understand what the conflict is and you can sympathise with it. Professionally, one person is giving you the instructions. They're the boss. You listen to them and you put everything else to one side.
Kim Heptonstall died at 8:05 a.m. on July 20, 2019. The ambulance left her home at 9:32 a.m. that morning. At 2:39 p.m. that afternoon, a login was entered into an app on her phone, the same phone she used to take countless pictures of her life and her family. The app was for the REST Superannuation Fund, of which she was a member. She had been in touch with REST just recently to confirm she was able to withdraw some funds to pay for her gastric sleeve operation. She was able, and those funds were made available. But now, inside that app, after she has died, another detail was being sought out and then changed. Damien, I know you weren't in court, but you have some details of the case and of the story. So what changed?
Oh, Tim, a very significant detail. What changed was who would be the elected beneficiary of that superannuation fund, which at that time totaled over $400,000. So on the morning of July 20th, the beneficiary was to be the estate of Kimberly Heppenstall. That afternoon, after that detail was changed, and just 6 hours after Kim had died, the beneficiary became Travis Paul Barnard. And the person who made that change, Travis Paul Barnard.
And they were not the only changes he made using Kim's phone that day. Around 20 minutes before logging into the REST Super app, Barnard logged into Kim's Westpac banking app. She had three accounts, and Barnard, through his knowledge of her passwords, logged into them and moved some money around. At 2:25 p.m., again on the same day Kim died, Barnard transferred $493.38 from one account to another, and then a smaller sum 2 minutes later. At 4:38 p.m. that day, he withdrew $790 from Kim's account from an ATM. Damien, the life of a criminal lawyer, and I have to say a court reporter, is sprinkled with, let's call them WTF moments, when you hear allegations which make you think or sometimes say out loud, WTF. I have to say, when I heard this in court this week, I didn't say it out loud because the judge would have probably looked down very harshly on me, but I certainly thought it.
The WTF, we won't translate, but essentially, for anyone who doesn't know, means what is actually happening here or what has actually happened here. And in my role, and I'm sure it's the same for you, Tim, and your colleagues, it does happen all the time. But what I find is, like, you can actually break down a series of events. And in my experience, 9 times out of 10, you can get to the motive. Mm. You can get to what it is. You might not be able to get to why a person makes a decision to do what they've done or what their process is, but you can generally get to the bottom of what the motive is. And unfortunately, 90% of the time, it's money.
Mm.
You know, money plays a huge part in the lives that we all live. And one of the other things that I was going to raise with you, Tim, is that the digital footprint, it's... Because that's what creates that WTF moment, isn't it?
Mm.
The digital footprint. At what point do people who are using phones and using computers every day in 2024 or even 2020 not realise that as soon as you open your phone, there becomes this digital footprint that's left behind? And
I think the young people call it keeping the receipts. There's always a receipt these days of whatever you do online or electronically.
Yeah, I just am blown away sometimes when my phone tells me what's happened. It literally, life goes like that now. It's like if you think, well, hang on, where was I on that day? You can go back through your phone, you can find something on your bank statement, and this is this digital footprint. And it seems from you know, what's transpired in this case, at some point, that must have been overlooked. That part must have been overlooked.
Mm.
Or there was a plan in place to try to avert that. Mm. So what actually happened? Well, I wasn't there, but it seems like it's this week in court being played out pretty loudly.
Yeah. And again, these WTF moments in cases, I have to write about them and then ask myself, well, how and why? And it goes to the point you were just making about when you have to ask an accused perhaps how and why. They're very important questions for you professionally, obviously, because you're going to need to know that information. But are they difficult conversations to have sometimes as well?
Extremely difficult conversations. I mean, for me personally, I find it a little bit easier if the person I'm talking to is young. And when I say young, you'd understand, Tim, that legally people are regarded to be young up until they're about 24, 25. I tend to give a little bit more grace than that. I sort of think people are young up until about 30. And when they're young, it's a little bit easier to be able to say, look, how did you get there? Mm. How did you get to that decision? Because you can generally anticipate that they will afford the mistake to bad decision making.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm speaking to somebody of my own ilk,
vintage.
Hey, take now, come on. it's difficult because you're essentially looking across the table at somebody who is essentially the same as you, the same age, they've lived as long as you. And then you're saying to them, what on earth possessed you to do this? Mm. Has an element of judgment about it. So you trim it back. Mm. Why did you do this?
Mm.
But I find that when you ask that question like that without a little bit of passion, if passion's the right word, without a little bit of gusto, it's easier to answer. why did you do this? Oh, I did this. But if you say, what on earth possessed you to do this? It actually makes the person dig in a little bit because, you know, for the if a person's convicted and they're going to go to sentencing, some of the things that they can say off the back of that pressing question can actually be quite helpful for them. And look, sometimes when people are trying to make a decision about whether they're pleading guilty or not guilty, asking that question in that way can sometimes present a defence. So it when it's people my own age, it's a little bit more difficult than the younger people, but it always comes down to the same thing, something along the lines of, what on earth were you thinking when you made that decision? You know, just really exacerbated and enough to make them think, oh, the lawyer's actually quite animated at the moment. This is obviously a really stupid thing I've done, or it's alleged that I've done. So that's how I would approach it, Tim.
The days after Kimberley's death were obviously a blur of grief for her family. Her mother, Linda, her brothers, Ben and Daniel, her friends, in shock at how someone so full of life could be gone so suddenly. And there were obviously practicalities among the pain, including getting some of Kim's things returned before her funeral. Her jewellery, her dog, and her phone. Because the family believed it would contain so many photographs of Kim and her life, some of which they wanted to include on a slideshow to be played at her funeral service. They rang Barnard and asked for the phone back, but he told them he hadn't finished with it. They rang again, same answer. And so they asked a family friend to get it for them. A meeting was arranged, then another, and eventually the phone was handed over. But it came back lighter. Her brother Ben thought there would be a lot more photos stored. Social media apps were gone, Instagram and Facebook, despite Kim using them all the time to post her life's progress. And other apps were gone as well, like her banking app and her superannuation app. It was weird and suspicious. So suspicious, in fact, that Ben downloaded a data recovery tool on his own computer and then thought better of that and sent it away to a professional company to try and find out what had gone from that phone and what had gone on. 1 year and 1 day after their sister and daughter had died, the Heptonstall family gave their phone to someone else. AFP investigator Stuart McDonald. Damien, paint us a picture of how a defence lawyer such as yourself might go attempting to challenge or test the data that is inevitably presented to you in cases, as you've mentioned, the digital footprint. I mean, that wouldn't be easy to do or cheap, I would imagine, when you're faced with evidence like this.
Well, if the police or the investigating body decide that the phone is relevant and important, they have got a very sophisticated system to get access to it, and they'll download everything and it'll be provided to the lawyers by way of disclosure. And in that disclosure, it's very complex. Well, when I say complex, it's a significant amount of information set out the way that it has to be set out so that people who know how to read it can read it. And
sometimes it can be terabytes of information, can't it? I mean, it can be, if you were to print it out physically, you know, you would put a significant dent in forests north of Perth, I would think.
You would, Tim. And if you keep it digitally, one of the problems that exists with that telephone data is they're on Excel sheets, which spread all the way over to the right. So you not only got to go up and down, you've got to go across and left as well. But what, in my experience, and other people might have had different experiences, it's very difficult to find holes in that evidence. Look, I haven't had any success with it, but one of the parts of that data that still seems to have some scope for challenging is when they're GPSing the phone with the towers. They'll triangulate three or four towers, and they can put a person in to a certain radius area. So you've got a bit of scope there, but generally speaking, the prosecution or a prosecuting body won't raise it unless it's so significant that the person was even remotely in that area. But look, Tim, can I just, first of all, I say don't commit any offences or crimes, but if you are going to do that, don't Instagram it. Don't put it on X. Don't put it on Facebook. And it seems comical, but the amount of people that will come to me and show me their phone with them doing a burnout up in the hills in their car, and then they say to me, how did the police know it was me? Because, like, just in that example there, one of the things that will happen there is that when you're doing that burnout, you'll be annoying someone, and that person will look on social media and find the car and report you to the police, and the police can find it. That's a blatant use of the phone and how it can track you down. But in terms of, I think the most important thing that where we live in 2024 is people don't leave their phone anywhere. And almost to the point that when, in a case when it comes up that the phone wasn't taken with the person,
becomes suspicious.
So it's a very relevant starting point. I think, you know, almost in all of the cases that we have now, when police are arresting people or they're taking them in for an interview, one of the first things that they do is take the phone off them.
Travis Barnard was also pretty well occupied in the weeks and months after Kimberley's death. In August 2019, he made a formal application to be granted the monies contained in Kim Heptonstall's superannuation account. That application came 5 days after her funeral. Barnard, according to those that were at that funeral, did not attend the wake. Around the same time he was applying for that money, he was also posting online on various sites, including Locanto, advertising his services as a male escort, as he had done before in May 2019, when Kimberley was still alive and they were still together. He was also active elsewhere online, on dating sites, on singles, Facebook pages, as he had been also when Kimberley was alive. And on the evening of July 20, 2019, the night that Kimberley died, he asked another woman out for a drink. I like to open doors, even when it's raining, to make sure you're dry, or go get the car for you, offer my jacket when it's cold, and always making them feel this is how a woman should always be treated. They were Travis Barnard's words on one of those posts on one of those sites, looking for love, in December 2020, a few months after his property had been visited by the AFP. After he had been questioned about those movements in Kimberley's bank accounts, and some months after he had first appeared in court, charged with the Commonwealth offence, which carried a maximum penalty of 7 years in prison, a charge he denied from the outset. Damien, fraud charges and cases at times can be crushingly complicated and crushingly boring to listen to sometimes, involving, you know, forensic accountants and accounts and trusts and all sorts of other numerical nasties. Others, though, as you touched on previously, about two things: people and money.
People and money. They seem to try to walk hand in hand, but we seem to be in conflict with money all the time. Mm. And my view is a little bit different, Tim. I think that fraud cases, when you first get them or when they first arrive and start going through them, they can seem to be crushingly complicated. Mm. But ultimately, it's someone representing something that's not true that causes something to happen as a result of that. And when you're working through them, you're just simply trying to get to the bottom of what the misrepresentation was, mm-hmm. in terms of...
Or if there was one. Yeah.
And I think it's important to understand in that context that the misrepresentation has to be intentional. There has, you know, mm-hmm. might be a case that a person believed that was the case.
Yep.
But, and that's the question about, you know, people in terms of what the person who potentially committed the fraud's intention was.
Yeah.
And whether it's they're trying to have... gain some financial benefit, mm-hmm. or whether they're trying to gain some financial benefit for someone else, mm-hmm. or, you know, what the outcome of that is. So they are extremely common. There's and not just my office, I hear from a lot of my colleagues about the fraud matters that are going on. And they do generally involve death. Mm. Like there is a lot of, once someone passed, they don't have the ability to affect or recognise what you might be doing in post their passing. So, yeah, it's not uncommon for that kind of charge to come up.
And obviously these civil cases that go to the Supreme Court about when people die intestate and challenges of wills and all that, but you're talking about people dying and then their money going somewhere, and obviously it's not them that moved it. So, and they're, in your experience, those cases are becoming more common.
I don't think they're becoming more common. I think they've existed for a long. Well, actually, in my experience as a lawyer, there's always been a digital existence of banking. Mm. So for me, there's always been the ability for people to log in to some kind of account and transfer. But I'm sure that it was happening, forever, going to Landgate and changing the name on a title or whatever it might have been. Mm. But it's just with that digital footprint now, it's so much easier to get caught. And because it's so much easier to affect.
To do it.
But it's also so much easier to get caught.
Mm. Travis Barnard, in his collection of brightly coloured shirts, was pretty hard to miss as he came and went from Court 61 this week. Prosecutor Carolyn Moss didn't miss either in her opening address. She outlined how Kimberley died and when, and then detailed the intended, deliberate, intentional actions of Barnard just 6 hours later. He intended to defraud the estate. He knew he had no right and demonstrates a sense of entitlement, Miss Moss told the jury. The evidence began with Kim's mother and brother telling of their loved daughter and sister and telling of her relationship with her boyfriend. How Kimberley and Barnard had met, moved in, and then got engaged, but then, they said, had drifted. Linda told of an intervention in early 2018, which led to Barnard being shown the door. Kim stayed for a while and then left to live with him again, but the wedding was off and was never put back on again. Damien, you can never truly know what goes on behind closed doors, but Kim's family obviously had told a very different story to Barnard about the state of their relationship. Do you find that a common occurrence as well when one of the parties is no longer around? And how do judges and juries, I suppose, sort of pick a side, for want of a better phrase?
Well, Tim, I would say that the what goes on behind closed doors that we'll never know the actual truth about doesn't just happen when one of the parties is no longer with us. Mm. I think it happens even when both of the parties are still with us. And I think one of the important things to remember about this human anomaly is that people have different versions of circumstances. And the different version of circumstances is a person's perspective. So when you get to a position where one of the parties can no longer say what their version is, it's not uncommon for their family to pick up what their perception, even if their perception was different to what the actual person was. Mm-hmm. So, from what I can tell in this case, that the two had been in a relationship that had not been without its ups and downs, but they were still in the relationship. And it might have been the case that Kim's family were not overly big on the relationship continuing. Mm. And in terms of the judiciary or judges and juries, the only way that they can pick a side, you know what my answer is going to be, is the evidence. Mm. And that's a difficult task, especially for juries, because there's 12 people trying to make a determination about a human who's given evidence in front of them or on the video screen. Mm. And each of those 12 people accepting different parts of each of the versions that you hear.
Coming from different life experiences, different cultures, language.
Everything. And it's an extremely difficult process. And sometimes, when I'm in a position where a jury goes out, and I know that credibility is something that's an issue, which is what the thrust of that is about. Who do we believe?
Mm-hmm.
I feel for the jury. I know that there'll be stronger personalities in the jury room that'll be boisterous about what their views are. And there'll be people who hold the same value on their views but don't have the same ability to express it.
Mm-hmm.
So I always feel for juries when they're going out to make a decision like that.
Mm. And that behind closed doors comment brought to mind, like family violence cases. I mean, they are almost exclusively, universally something that's happened in a relationship that no one else is really aware of, you know, the exactitudes of it, unless there happens to be a recording or something, which is not uncommon, but it's, you know, it's not, again, not universal. And a lot of times juries are having to make a decision about, you know, a couple's relationship as well as whether they believe them or not.
Absolutely, yeah. So, how many times in my office one of my clients or someone will come in with a video on their phone. Mm. Here we are back at the phone, keeping track of everything. And they'll show you the video and you'll look at the video in the context of everything that your client might have told you. You say, oh, this is, we're home and hose here. This is exactly. But the first thing the other party will say is that video is out of context.
Mm.
You didn't see what happened the 10 minutes before that.
Mm.
And we're right back to square one.
Yeah.
So I think that it's really important, not just legally, but in life, to accept that sometimes, 90% of the time, people's versions will be different. It doesn't necessarily mean that one person's right or wrong.
Mm. Kim's brother Ben told the court about hearing of the claim for Kim's super days after he had buried his sister. Rest superannuation executives told the court how their app worked and how a change inside their system would and should take just seconds to log. And then the court heard from Travis Barnard, first during his conversation with the officers who raided his house, and then in person when he chose to give evidence. He told police, in between long pauses, that he had accessed Kim's bank accounts. And he was then shown a letter from a debt collector before conceding he had recently been bankrupted. But he flatly denied changing the name of her superannuation beneficiary to himself. And he did the same in the witness box, insisting it must have been someone else. Someone else, he claimed, who had her phone and her password, and the motive to change the beneficiary to the name of Travis Barnard. Claims the prosecutor, Carolyn Moss, later labelled ludicrous. Damien, talk us through the pros and cons of a defendant giving evidence themselves.
I'll do a simple version. If someone accuses you of stealing a car and the police believe it, and you get charged, it then becomes the prosecution's responsibility to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that you did that.
Mm-hmm.
The witness comes along and says, I owned that car, and then it went missing on Thursday night and I haven't seen it since, and he's the only other person who knew where it was parked, and it was found in his garage 4 days later. So now everybody's heard what the allegation is. If you don't get up and say anything, there's nothing to defend. You know, give some context about you thought you were borrowing the car or whatever mm-hmm. it is. So in terms of not giving evidence, you leave the allegation open to not being defended.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, one of the things that people have got to think about, I always give advice, is that when you give evidence, you have to be prepared that you're going to be cross-examined.
Mm.
And that is giving, generally, usually speaking, a very talented prosecutor the opportunity to bring you undone.
Mm.
And if you are lying, they are going to bring you undone. So if you are lying, let's just plead guilty now and save ourselves all the drama of it. But if you're telling the truth, it's better that you get in there and tell the truth and give your best version of what you can say.
Mm.
So, look, I think in every case, pros and cons are different. But the simple version is that if you don't answer the allegation, it leaves it open for someone to be satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt that it happened. If you do try to answer the allegation, you open yourself up to cross-examination where you can be brought unstuck.
Mm. And if you, as their lawyer, believe it's a bad decision, for them to get up on the witness stand, and it won't help them, but they insist on doing it anyway. Where does that leave you?
Well, it's a very complex and costly position to be in. And the reason that is because if you are in a position where your view is that it'll be detrimental to their case if they give evidence, and it's not going to advance them any further along, which can be the case sometimes, but they insist on telling their story, you give them that advice, and you make sure you talk through them point by point. Try to point out in all of the evidence where it is that the prosecution case has already come unstuck and they don't need to address anything. And then say to them, my advice is that you shouldn't give evidence, but ultimately it's your choice. Mm. And make sure, well, as a lawyer, you'd make sure that you'd crossed all your T's and dotted your I's, and anyone who practices will know what that means. But it's a difficult position to be in, but that's part of being a lawyer.
Mm. And there was a case just recently where a senior barrister was seriously wrapped over the knuckles for not giving that proper advice about whether to give evidence in their own defence. So, I mean, it's taken very seriously the advice that you actually give. But as long as you believe it and it's fulsome, then you've done your job. But ultimately, it's up to the client, right?
Correct.
Mm. It took the jury 6 days to get to the point of retiring to consider a verdict against Travis Barnard. It took them less than 1 hour to come back with that verdict. Guilty. And it took Judge David McLean less time than that to decide that while he waits to be sentenced, Travis Barnard can wait in a cell. Because, Judge McLean said, the almost inevitable outcome for him is a decent-sized prison term with time to serve. The outcome was bittersweet for the Heptonstall family. Nearly 5 years they had endured the nightmare of sudden death, coroner, funeral, and then court after court after court. Time they should have spent grieving was also taken up in administrative conflict along with the justice system. After they discovered Barnard had applied to be given Kim's significant superannuation, they challenged that. And they then applied for letters of administration. And then they battled. After that, Superannuation Trust originally did award that money to Kim's partner. That decision was reversed, but then appealed by Barnard to the Australian Financial Complaints Authority. They investigated thoroughly and actually ruled that despite his infidelity or attempts at it, he could and should be classed as Miss Heptonstall's de facto partner, and therefore a potential legitimate dependent and beneficiary. But they also said this: the complainant's conduct demonstrates he did not have a commitment to a shared life with the deceased. Now he will share the next part of his life with fellow prisoners. Damien, what do you think the main factors will be when Judge McLean comes to sentence Mr. Barnard in a couple of months?
Two principles jump out at me: personal deterrence and general deterrence. And you would have heard those terms countless
many times, yes.
Tim, for the general public, personal deterrence is when a sentence is imposed upon somebody with a purpose of making them understand that they can't do something like this in the future. General deterrence is when a sentence is imposed on somebody with the purpose of letting the general public know that this is what would happen to them if they did something like this. And I think those two factors will be significant in not just Judge McLean's, but any judge's sentencing of someone in Mr. Barnard's position. But also, depending on what comes out in any reports or anything that is provided as well, whether he's accepted some responsibility, whether he's got the ability to turn that around, or does the judge form the view that that he's likely to commit offending like this again in the future. I think they're the most significant factors. I imagine there'll be some victim impact statements. Any judge in this position's got a difficult task.
Mm.
Because it's always my view, Tim, that even when people make mistakes like this, like Mr. Barnard has, there's still good in them somewhere. Mm. And it's a matter of a judge determining how soon they can let that person actually try to be a good contributing member of the community again.
Mm. One short postscript to this case. Travis Barnard has one other case running through WA's courts at the moment, a civil action in WA's Supreme Court, suing the Heptonstall family for that superannuation money. A mediation conference is due to be held next month. Travis Barnard's sentencing is in June, and my tip is that we'll be hearing a bit more about the background of Travis Barnard in that hearing and after. Damien, mate, pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us today, getting the old band back together. Your band's playing this weekend somewhere?
I'm having the weekend off, Tim. Oh. It's Easter. I'm going to have a little bit of chocolate and go back to the back catalogue of Caught in the Act, because I don't want to get caught short, so I'll re-listen to all of those episodes again.
Well, as I say, thanks very much for sharing some time, and enjoy what little time you have off over the weekend. And thanks to you all for joining us again. Please don't hesitate to get in touch with us by writing to caughtintheact@wanews.com.au. Don't forget, like and subscribe. Tell your friends, family, colleagues, even your co-accused, all about us. And remember, if you want to know what's going on in court, don't get caught short. Get caught in it instead. See you next week.